This is Road to Calvary with Pastor Dave Cook of Calvary Baptist Church on today's edition.
It's very telling that a mere mortal can steal one of these gods. That doesn't say much for their power, does it? And while Rachel has stolen these quote-unquote gods, and it also tells us that Jacob has stolen Laban's heart. Now, that's not the way it's worded in our English text. That's literally what it means in the Hebrew. The word that's translated tricked literally means to steal one's heart.
The Bible is full of adventure and intrigue. And today, Pastor Dave shares a dramatic story of Jacob's escape from Laban. He reminds us of God's power to intervene and rescue us from our enemies. God tells Jacob to arise and flee and return to his father's home. His wife Rachel takes her father's idols. Laban is very displeased and pursues Jacob. God appears to Laban in a dream and tells him to be careful. Like Jacob, God can intervene in our lives and protect us when we are obedient to his word. Now, here's Pastor Dave in the book of Genesis chapter 31 as he continues his message, Homeward Bound.
The angel of God said to me in the dream, Jacob, and I said, here I am. And he said, lift up your eyes and see all the goats that mate with the flock are striped, spotted, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Now arise, go out from this land and return to the land of your kindred. Now I mentioned, although I didn't go into the full detail of it, I did mention this dream. And I said that Jacob must have had this dream prior to the agreement with Laban. And in fact, I said it was likely that this dream was why Jacob made that deal with Laban, because otherwise it seems like a ridiculous deal to make, unless he really had faith in his stick superstition there. But at the end of, and I do believe that that's the case, but at the end of the dream, we see God instructing Jacob, whenever he had this dream, to arise and return to the land. So if he received this, because at this point, it's been 6 years since that initial deal. So if he received this dream and this command years earlier, we could ask the question, well, why is he still here? Or maybe I'm just wrong about the timing. Well, I still think this was before the agreement. And God's command, I believe, allowed for time for these flocks to breed and for him to accumulate these animals that he was to accumulate before he actually left, which is why God comes back to him here in verse 3 to say, okay, the time of breeding, the time of your accumulation of more livestock is over, and now it's time to go. So how did Leah and Rachel respond to these revelations that Jacob is giving to them? Well, we can see here they're certainly not shy in sharing their opinions. If you look at verses 14 and 16, we see what they had to say about it. It says, then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? For he has sold us, and he has indeed devoured our money, all the wealth that God has taken away. And interesting, I'll pause there for a second. When it says all the wealth that God has taken away, that word is also can be translated plundered. It's the exact same word in Exodus when the Israelites are heading out and God told them to ask all the people around them for their gold and stuff. And they asked for the gold and jewelry, and all of the Egyptians gave all their gold and jewelry to the Israelites. And it said, thus they plundered the Egyptians. That's the same word that's used here. So you can see a tie-in even from here to Exodus. So God has plundered our father. But all of that, the wealth that God has taken away or plundered from our father, belongs to us and to our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do. So what are they saying here? They're saying there's nothing left for us here. We have no inheritance. Our father has sold us to you. And the bride price, which was supposed to be held for their care in case Jacob were to die early, apparently Laban has devoured in some way. And perhaps he means just because it went all to Jacob through the flock. Perhaps he was just did not take care of his funds, or he spent it on his own stuff. We don't know. But whatever it is, they're saying that Laban has devoured what should have been ours. So they see that what Jacob has received from God is what should have been theirs anyway, and they're ready to go. So everyone seemingly is on board with this plan. The decision is made. And so we move on from the decision to the actual departure. So we move on to the departure for home. Jacob put his children, he put his wives on camels, he drives out this livestock that he's accumulated ahead of him, and he's headed out to the land of Canaan. For lack of a better term, the proto-Exodus is on, it's begun. Just like Moses, Jacob is taking his people, his family, out from oppression and headed to the land of promise. And the text makes sure to point out that all that Jacob took with him was what he gained and what he acquired, the words that are used in Paddan Aram, in Haran. He's only taking what's his. He's not taking anything that does not belong to him. And not only does it tell us that, it also tells us indirectly that this is the ideal time for him to go, because as we see in verse 19, while they're putting all this stuff together and packing their stuff up and ready to head out, Laban is not there. He's away shearing his sheep. And now shearing, of course, you know, I've never taken care of sheep. And it's not, certainly shepherding is not as popular of a vocation as it once was. But reportedly, this is a huge event. This is not something that is just, oh, let's go over and shear the sheep for an hour. We'll come back for lunch. That's not what we're talking about. This is a big deal that required a lot of manpower, sometimes hundreds of people and multiple days. So Laban and his sons, probably along with most, if not all, of their servants are involved, and they're off shearing the sheep. So it was a good time for Jacob and his family and his servants and all of his stuff to head out of Dodge. The other information we're given about their departure is that on the way out, Rachel takes a little detour and grabs her father's quote-unquote household gods. These are called teraphim. They're essentially idols that could be set up in a household shrine for worship. Many years later, you may remember the story when David is married to Saul's daughter, Michal. And, you know, Saul is going after him to take David out. And David was with Michal. She says, go out through the window because they're coming for you. And then she takes what is the same kind of thing, one of these teraphim, these household gods, and she puts it in the bed and puts it under the covers to kind of look like David's there, to hopefully delay these people who are coming so that David has time to get away. Now, clearly in that case, this idol, this household god was near life-size, but as we'll see, clearly the household gods that were Laban's, that Rachel stole, had to be much smaller. We're not told what Rachel's reason was for taking these idols. It's possible that she had some degree of belief in them and believed that they would provide protection for her family as they headed on their journey. It's possible she, out of spite, just wanted to hurt her father, because she knew that it would bother him that these were taken, and she's trying to get back at him for what he's done to not only her, but also to Jacob. The idols also, we found out that Laban was involved, at least potentially, in some type of divination, and she wanted to deprive him, possibly, of that ability, which may make their escape easier if he doesn't have access to this, whatever occultic divination he's using these things for. So that's possible as well. Or it's also could be very basic. These teraphim would have been made out of either gold or silver, and perhaps she's just taking them for the money and saying, you know what, I'm owed. My father owes me, so I'm taking these, and I'm going to use them for monetary purposes. So that's possible. But whatever the reason, it's really telling when you think about it. If you actually think about that these things are described as gods, it's very telling that a mere mortal can steal one of these gods. That doesn't say much for their power, does it? And while Rachel has stolen these quote-unquote gods, and it also tells us that Jacob has stolen Laban's heart. Now, that's not the way it's worded in our English text. That's literally what it means in the Hebrew. The word that's translated tricked literally means to steal one's heart. But it doesn't mean it the way we would think of stealing one's heart, like I've stolen your heart, like we're in love or something. That's not what it means here. It actually means, it's an idiom that means deception. You've stolen my heart. You've betrayed me. You've tricked me. So that's why it's translated that way in our English. You have a wordplay that goes on in the Hebrew. You know, she stole the gods and he's stolen Laban's heart. So he tricked Laban, or stole his heart, by not telling him that he was leaving. Verse 21 tells us he fled with all that he had and arose and crossed the Euphrates and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. Now, it's interesting that it uses the terms here. It says that he arose and that he fled. And that's interesting because at the beginning of this journey, when he betrayed his, or seemingly betrayed his brother, and his brother is upset, his mother told him to do that very thing, to arise and to flee, to get away from Esau. That was back in chapter 27, verse 43. So now, at the end of this 20-year journey into Haran, Jacob's doing the same thing. He's arising and he's fleeing. When Laban returns from shearing the sheep, he finds a startling discovery that a significant portion of his family are missing. Jacob, his daughters, all of his grandchildren are gone. And not only that, he discovers that these household gods, these idols, are also missing. And he, suffice it to say, is not happy. He's not happy. So we move on from the decision to the departure to now the displeasure of Laban. You can see a pattern here, right? The displeasure of Laban. So by the time that Laban knows that Jacob and company are gone, it's been 3 days already. They have a 3-day head start. But that doesn't discourage Laban from going after them. Verse 23 says that he took his kinsmen with him and he pursued him for 7 days and followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. Now, why it took him 7 days to catch up, not sure, but because they would have been lighter and travel faster, but it took them 7 days for whatever reason. Pursued them for 7 days, followed close after him into the hill country of Gilead. So the hunt is on. But during the pursuit, Laban receives an unexpected visitor. Much like Paul on the road to Damascus, Laban meets someone he did not plan on meeting. And it says, God came to Laban, the Aramean, in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad." This intervention by God here may remind you of another person who found himself on the opposing side of God's chosen man. Back in chapter 20, Abimelech, King Abimelech, took Sarah to be his wife, not knowing that she was already married to Abraham because they had lied to him. They had told Abimelech that Sarah was Abraham's sister. And God appeared to him in a dream as well, much like he did here with Laban. And he said, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Abimelech, of course, said, "Wait a minute. I had no idea. They did not tell me that. They told me a different story altogether." Of course, God assured him, "Yeah, I know the details. I know what happened. And I've been holding you back from actually committing sin here. But I want you to know," God says to Abimelech, "if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So we can say very simply that if God hadn't intervened, Abimelech would have sinned with Sarah. And also it would have cost him his life. And we can say also that if God didn't intervene here with Laban, there would have been violence that would have occurred between Laban and Jacob. Laban was upset. God protects his people. And he protects his people because he is going to bring about his plans. He is sovereign. No one can thwart the plans that he has made. But this dream that Laban had, the way we see it worded in English, we could think something different than what it actually means. God isn't telling him that he can't speak to Jacob at all, because then he certainly would have been discounting it. As he gets there, he does talk to Jacob and even calls him out on what he feels like Jacob did wrong. But what God is doing here by saying, don't say anything to him, either good or evil, he's telling him, you don't threaten him, you're not going to cause him any harm, and you're also not going to sweet talk him and try to lure him back to your house. I'm moving him on. That's what God's telling him to do. You're not causing him any harm, and you're not sweet talking him back into your service. Neither one of those things are going to be allowed. So that's what he's doing there. So when Laban arrives, he does, in fact, confront Jacob. See this in verse 26. It says, "And Laban said to Jacob, 'What have you done that you have tricked me and driven away my daughters like captives of the sword?'" It's so dramatic right here. Laban's accusing Jacob of taking Leah and Rachel away from his home by force. And the word that he uses there, he says that Jacob has driven them away. And that's the same words that are used to describe the way Jacob treated the sheep as he's driving them before them. So basically he's saying, you treated my daughters like animals and drove them out of my home. And of course it's telling that he refers to Leah and Rachel as my daughters, not to Jacob as your wives. He's trying to gain the moral upper hand here. He's acting as if, after that we see in the text, he acts as if, all I wanted to do was be able to send you off with a going away party. I just wanted to be able to come and celebrate your departure, to be able to give a proper goodbye to my daughters and my grandkids, to be able to give them a kiss and a hug as you're going on your way. By saying this, and we know this is, we see through this, right? I hope we all see through this. This is not really his intent. He never intended to let them go. He's trying to gain sympathy, perhaps from his own kinsmen that are with him, to get them to be fully on his side, or probably he's also trying to generate a little emotion, a little sympathy from his daughters as well. I just wanted to be able to say goodbye to you, have a party, celebrate. But then he says something interesting, and you see he's trying to puff himself up, because he says here, again, he's trying to keep the upper hand, and he says, it's in my power to do you harm. Kind of skirting on the edge of a threat there, not overtly, but close. But then he continues on to say, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. Now, at least in that, Laban is telling the absolute truth. He's accurately relaying what God had said to him. But it's actually because of that message that the first part of his statement comes across as hollow. He does not actually have the power to bring harm to Jacob because God is not going to allow it. He's trying to hang on to whatever sense of power and authority that he can. And we do that so often, don't we? We just want to hang on to our own sense of importance, that we're in control. Then he acknowledges, look, I understand, Jacob, why you'd want to go back to Canaan. I get it. I understand. It makes sense to me. He says, you have gone away because you've longed greatly for your father's house. I get it. But then he comes with an accusation. And he says, but why did you steal my gods? Again, is that a statement you would never expect someone to say? Why did you steal? How can you steal a god? But he assumes here that Jacob is the thief. He's kind of implying, listen, your God spoke to me. I'm respecting what he asked of me. I'm respecting your God. I'm obeying his command regarding you. But you're not respecting my gods. You stole them. So Jacob then responds. He gives a reason for the first accusation, which was at least in part true. He did certainly slip away without telling Laban he was leaving. But then he outrightly denies this second charge, which of course we know he is innocent of. His explanation for sneaking away is found in verse 31. He said, because I was afraid, for I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. So think about this. Laban is accusing Jacob. You took my daughters by force. And Jacob's saying back, I was afraid you're going to take your daughters, my wives, from me by force. There's deep distrust here. Deep distrust. As for the accusation of theft, Jacob is very clear. Anyone with whom you find your gods shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have that is yours and take it. He's challenging him right back. Point out, you see something that's yours? Let's bring it on the table and let's let everyone else judge. Now, of course, unknowingly, Jacob has just sentenced his beloved Rachel to the death penalty if she's discovered. But of course, it tells us in the text that Jacob had no idea. He had no idea Rachel had done this. And even if it didn't tell us that he had no idea that Rachel had done this, the fact that he said what he said, knowing how he feels about Rachel, should tell us that he didn't know what Rachel had done. So Laban, of course, not taking his word, conducts a thorough search of everyone's tent, starting with Jacob, ending with Rachel. And when Laban is there in Rachel's tent, we're told what Rachel has actually done with these idols. Up to this point, we know she took them. We don't know what she did with them. Verse 34 says, now Rachel had taken the household gods and put them in the camel's saddle and sat on them. Now, just think about that for a minute, okay? Again, these are gods that Laban worships, and they were not only godnapped, but they were taken, shoved in a saddle, and then a woman sat on them. Just keep that image in your mind there for a second. It says, Laban felt all about the tent, but did not find them. So again, Rachel sitting on her father's quote-unquote gods. And then to make matters worse, she says to her father in the very next verse, "Let not my Lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the way of women is upon me." Now, we know what that means, right? We get that. That's not too oblique. We understand the statement there. Now, the events of this story certainly occur well before the law was given to the Israelites at Sinai. But the initial audience that Moses wrote this book to, this history to, was Jews who were under the law. And put yourself in those shoes. Put yourself in the shoes of Jews who are under the Mosaic law hearing this story or reading this story. For Rachel to sit on these household gods during her period, her menstruation, that would have gotten their attention. Make no mistake. Leviticus chapter 15, verse 20 says that anything a woman sits on during that period is made unclean. So the Jews are seeing as they're reading this story, and I don't think this was an untrue statement even back during Jacob's day. This would have been considered unclean even then. But the Jews are hearing this story, and they're seeing the complete and utter impotence of these gods that they could be subjected to this kind of shame and made ritually unclean. That's definitely a message to the Israelites there, and also to us. Laban probably can't even conceive that his daughter would do that. He's not making her get up because he can't even imagine that that would enter her mind to do such a thing. Anyway, in any event, Laban's unable to find these gods, and Jacob at that point has had enough. He has taken, you know, as Popeye said, "I've had all I can stands, and I can't stands no more," right? He's had enough here. And so he comes back at Laban with both barrels. Laban goes, searches everything, finds nothing that's his. And Jacob's just like, "All right, pal, here we go." So let's look now at the defense of Jacob. Now, many years later, David is going to complain to Jonathan about Saul, Jonathan's father, the king, how he's treated him, how he's treated David. David served Saul well, much like Jacob did Laban. But yet, Saul continually was trying to kill David. So David says to Jonathan in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 1, "What have I done? What is my guilt? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" And here Jacob takes a very similar tactic as he says to Laban, "What is my offense? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? For you have felt through all my goods. What have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen that they may decide between us two." Jacob's essentially saying here, "Look, I'll let even the guys on your side make the judgment because my innocence is clear before everybody. There's no one that can say that I did anything wrong here. Even your team can judge between us." And then 20 years of built-up mistreatment comes out toward Laban. Jacob says, verses 38 to 40, "These 20 years I've been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried. I've not eaten the rams of your flocks. What was torn by wild beasts, I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. From my hand, you required it." So he's not even saying that he was doing that out of just altruism. He's saying, "You made me do that. By my own hand, you have required it, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was, by day the heat consumed me, and the cold by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes." Now I think in this whole story, and as we're coming to where Jacob's at this point, I think we can see his growth. He is not any longer the same man that had betrayed his father and brother 20 years earlier.
We're so glad you listened with us today here on Road to Calvary. Our prayer is that this ministry, located in Riverhead, New York, out of Calvary Baptist Church, will gently touch your life and give you resources to deepen your relationship with Jesus. The Life and Legacy of Abraham is a series that Pastor Dave Cook has been teaching through as he refers to the book of Genesis. After creation and sin entered the world, the Lord pushed the restart button by sending a great flood. Although this was a catastrophic event, He had a plan to save mankind and provide an opportunity for a relationship with God. The first man he made this kind of promise to was Abraham. That would be quite the first experience, would it not? If you desire to hear more on this subject, we welcome you to visit our webpage at cbcriverhead.org. Under the Resources tab, you'll find past teachings from Pastor Dave Cook that you can watch or listen to. If that isn't what you're looking for today, no worries. We have a wide range of other resources geared just for that purpose. Again, go to cbcriverhead.org. We invite you to come check us out. Do you feel like there's no one you can talk to about your current season of life? We're here for you. So please utilize our biblical counseling by calling 631-727-4112 for more information. We're here for you. That number again is 631-727-4112. We can't wait to meet with you again on our next edition right here on Road to Calvary.